I'm not ashamed to say that I'm a bit fanatical about crows. They're by far the most nuanced birds that I've ever spent time with. They have complex habits and language, and I don't say this lightly, but I think that some of their behavior is, well, it's ritualistic. It's dusk right now, and we're in a wetland out in a suburb of Seattle. This wetland is where many of Seattle's crows, thousands of them, come each night to roost, and we want to see it happen.
Oh, there's a bunch of them on the
ledge over there. They're like hanging out there.
The sky is now black, full of crows, masses of them swirling and dive bombing each other and doing barrel rolls.
They're getting like tinkles in my body.
Holy s***.
Today on Here Be Monsters, we're going to be talking about crows, birds that live beside us nearly everywhere on the planet, birds that harass us and eat our trash, and birds that just might be able to teach humanity a bit about the origins of intelligence and emotion. Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
an exaggerated face.
The podcast about
the unknown. Known.
Crows had always been intriguing to me because they just seem like they're paying so much more attention.
This is Kaylee Swift. She's a graduate student at the University of Washington in Seattle. Her research is attempting to parse out the complex relationships that crows have with humans.
It's hard to describe. People who like crows are instantly familiar with that experience of just feeling like they're watching you back. You just don't get that feeling with many other wild animals, especially birds.
While crows are far from the only species to watch humans, they are somewhat unique because of just how good they are at it. And to understand why, we've got to rewind almost 10 years back to a study that took place here on the University of Washington campus.
Do you have the caveman mask here?
Yeah.
In this office?
No, it's downstairs in my lab.
Oh, it's downstairs.
It was almost a decade ago, back in 2006, when Kaylee's academic advisor...
I'm John Marsliff. I'm a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington.
...bought a cheap caveman mask on the internet.
This here.
Okay.
We don't have time to go downstairs and look at the caveman, do we?
Sure.
Oh, we do?
I can see who's...
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Today, the caveman mask lives in a basement storeroom, almost like a dungeon, to punish it for the things it's done to the birds on this campus. It sits on top of a display case with its orangish skin, its wide nose, its protruding teeth, and thick eyebrows.
Here's the caveman. Caveman's a really distinctive and exaggerated face.
One day in February of 2006, John put on the caveman mask and started walking around the heavily forested campus. He was carrying a net, and eventually he found a crow. He snuck up behind it, and he threw the net over top of it. The net didn't hurt the bird, but crows, like almost every animal, don't enjoy being trapped.
We band them, weigh them, measure them, let them go. We did that with seven birds while we wore the caveman mask. We thought they might associate that face with that experience.
And they did. 2 days later, John put the mask on again and walked around campus, and the moment a crow saw him, it reached deep into its crow vocabulary and gave John a loud scold.
A scold is a harsh, easily localized vocalization that...
Can you make the sound?
Sure, I can make the sound of it. It's basically...
But that crow, the one that was scolding John, it wasn't one of the seven that John had caught 2 days before. It must have watched what had happened from the trees above and watched as John took another crow hostage. and by scolding, it was loudly saying to the other crows in the area, it was saying, "Look, look at this caveman. This caveman is dangerous, just like a hawk or a raccoon or an owl. It's dangerous, and tell everyone else." And now, years later, John can still take this mask, put it on, and walk around campus, and find himself surrounded by angry crows.
That mask hasn't done anything for 8 years, but the birds on campus still respond to us like we're a predator, like we had, you know, killed these birds or threatened them with bodily harm. We didn't kill any of them, obviously.
Cacophonous aggregation is the scientific term. It's very descriptive scientifically. I personally prefer to use the term funeral because it conveys a much clearer message.
Today, Kaylee is taking John's research one step further. She wants to figure out what is going on inside the mind of a scolding crow. So she is looking into a related behavior. It's the strange and powerful response that crows have when one of their kind dies. It's called a cacophonous aggregation. It's the crow's death ritual, the crow funeral.
A crow funeral is an event where you have a bird who discovers a dead crow, and it will vocalize and recruit other birds to the scene. They will produce the scold call, caw, 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 caw. And they'll be flying around in the trees. And for about the next 10 to 20 minutes, those birds will produce that harsh scold sound. Sometimes there's a prolonged period of silence where they're just observing. And then after a certain period of time, they'll all disperse.
But there's a problem with observing crow funerals. You see, even though there are tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of crows living in Seattle, predicting where and when a crow funeral will happen is nearly impossible. So, with the help of some human volunteers and a taxidermied crow, Kaylee is making the funerals happen, manually.
So what I'm holding is a stuffed crow. The wings are sort of splayed out as they might be if it had died rather than tucked closely into the body. But you can see it has sort of those awkward, the way the wings are positioned is not something you would typically see of a healthy bird or of a living bird. Today is Friday?
Indeed.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. You would be Michelle.
Oh, Michelle.
This is Michelle. Yes, who I never had the fortune to meet as an actual person. So now she just lives on in my mind as the enemy of crows.
Kaylee is standing in front of me here on this busy street in central Seattle. She's holding a clipboard and she's describing the face I'm wearing.
Michelle's face is one of our more petite masks. Her lips are a little bit turned down. She's got a fairly almond-shaped face. Petite,
this mask is nothing like the exaggerated caveman. Michelle was molded from a real person and looks realistic enough to a careless passerby.
And then your personal eyes will be showing, so they'll be able to see your real eyes. Yep. What we're going to be doing, I'm going to give you the dead crow. You're just going to be holding the bird parallel to the ground. So just vary your gaze. Crows are attentive to human gaze.
As Kaylee gives me my instructions, I'm concealing the dead crow, hiding it in the plastic grocery bag. Kaylee walks over to a spot on the sidewalk and drops a pile of crow food, aka peanuts and Cheetos. She's been baiting these crows for 4 days, teaching them to show up here at a certain time for free food, so we have a guaranteed audience. Kaylee then nonchalantly recedes into the distance with her clipboard. I make my way over to the pile, slowly navigating as my vision is reduced to slits by the mask. Each time I exhale, I can feel the warm moisture of my breath trying to find an escape route from under the mask. The judging eyes of passing motorists and joggers burn into me as they go by. I'm wearing a sign around my neck that flaps in the wind. It reads, "University of Washington, Crow Study." And I look down at my mark on the sidewalk, next to the pile of Cheetos and peanuts, and I lift up the plastic bag, peel it off, and hold the light, soft body of the taxidermied crow parallel to the ground and slightly uplifted, like an offering. And I wait. I wait for the first crow to notice the bird that they will think I've just killed. My mask here serves two purposes. First, it's teaching the crows that Michelle is a dangerous person. Regardless of what human fills the mask, the crows will remember Michelle's face. The second reason isn't immediately apparent, but becomes obvious as several crows begin flying over to me. They're perched directly above, sitting on the power lines and scolding me in a way that is almost certainly the bird equivalent of pissed off yelling. And my initial distaste for the mask is suddenly replaced by a relief that my true identity is hidden from these crows. The scolding from the first crows that found me attracts other birds, and as I look at the power lines now, I can see that there are a dozen or more birds flapping around up there, looking at me and squawking loudly. And I can't help but wonder what exactly is going on up there in those 12 large brains.
What do you think is happening? Like, what is going on at a crow funeral?
Well, that's the central question of my research. I don't know the answer yet. It seems what the data is suggesting is that it's danger learning. It's an opportunity for them to learn more about their environment, and we know from other studies crows are doing a lot of that all the time. Now, that's not mutually exclusive with some kind of emotional response.
But saying that an animal is emotional, or even grieving, well, that's messy for a lot of reasons.
One of the challenges with studying animal emotions is you can't ask an animal what it's thinking. And I will not say whether or not I think that's what's happening. John and I have had this debate.
I think in some situations, some individuals, yes, they have the neurotransmitters, the chemicals in their brain that make them feel grief like we feel grief. They have the places in their brains like we do that would allow them to respond in the same way we do to grief. So I don't know if crows grieve. I will never know that because I can't talk to them. But I could look at their brain function and brain chemistry and see, is it the same when they see a situation like that as when we see one? And if they're the same, then I think you can conclude they're grieving.
Is it the same?
I don't know. We haven't done the experiment. I'd like to do it.
When you do the experiment, which you are planning on doing later this summer, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if it comes back and it does look like just to a T, the same sort of reaction that humans have when they're experiencing grief and loss, would you feel comfortable saying it then?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would. Not everybody would agree with me.
If you come out and you say, like, and your name's written on the paper and it says, crows are almost undeniably grieving,
right.
Are you going to get flack from some of your peers?
Probably not so much from my peers, not so much from biologists. The place I'll get flack is more likely from human psychologists who would claim that you just don't know unless you can have the conversation with them and talk to them about how they're feeling about something. And that's a valid point. I mean, it's a valid point. It's a valid point. It's a valid point.
So while that conversation with crows is impossible, John is doing his best to find the workaround. Right now, he's capturing more crows, a different set of crows from the caveman experiment. He's capturing them and then taking them down into the basement of the University of Washington Hospital, where he places them in a brain scanning machine. He then presents them with the lifeless body of a bird, and then watches the brain scan to see just how similar the crow response to grief is to ours. It's an impossible question, but hopefully John's brain scans will give us some preliminary answers. But for the moment, what we do have is the real world, here on this busy street, and what I have is a dozen angry crows, sitting on the power lines above me, conducting a cacophonous aggregation. Or maybe it is a funeral.
A challenge to me as a scientist who is also a human being is recognizing that when I'm observing and making interpretations about the natural world, I'm limited by my perception as a human. And I have to keep in mind that animals experience and interact with their environment differently than we do. And there may be ways in which they're experiencing that that are invisible to us. And so when they're conducting these funerals, there could be experiences, knowledge, or sensory input that we are just unaware of. So as a scientist, I never rule out the possibility of that sort of mystery.
So in all this stuff, this thing that I keep getting hung up on is this idea of spectrums, right? Because on one end of it, you have danger learning, what we know the crows do. They find something dangerous like a predator or a cheap caveman mask, and they learn to ostracize it and fear it and maybe even hate it. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you have this human response to death, which we as humans view as highly sophisticated and nuanced, with our coffins and our urns and our sky burials and our funeral pyres and our gods and our afterlives and the special music, and all of this, all of it is intrinsic to what we see as human culture. But that blindness of the human perspective that is so intrinsic to our study of animal behavior, well, it's a knife that cuts both ways. Because just as we are blind to the experiences of other animals, our anthropocentric perspective also obscures us from fully understanding our own emotions and rituals. And so the question that needs to be asked is whether or not the ends of this spectrum of experience are inherently separate, whether these words that we've been talking about, words like emotion and grief and sadness, should always be prefaced by the word human, or whether they stand on their own.
His Double Tongue by Thornton W. Burgess. Blackie the Crow sat in the top of a tall tree and seemed trying to see just how much noise he could make with that harsh voice of his.
Caw, 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 caw.
Peter Rabbit peered out from the dear old briar patch and frowned. If I had a voice as unpleasant as that, I'd forget I had a tongue.
This episode of Here Be Monsters was produced by me, Jeff Emmett. Big thank you to my brother, Brian Emmett, who first turned me on to John and Kaylee's research. Also, many thanks to David Kestenbaum of NPR's Planet Money, who was instrumental in the production of a much shorter version of this story that's coming to a radio station near you. In the sequence at the beginning of this episode, you heard from my two friends who biked out to the Crow Roost with me, Nora Gunning and Sam Capilotto, aka Lieutenant Dunkeries and the Sturgeon General. Here Be Monsters story editor is Bethany Denton. Our brand new producer in training is Grant Sprintz. Our listeners are amazing, that's always been true, but especially since last episode when we asked you to review the show on iTunes. And as I'm looking right now, we have 3 people who don't know what they're talking about and a whopping 102 5-star reviews. Thank you so much. And if you liked this episode, post a link on your Facebook wall and tag those 2 friends you have who are birders. Seriously, everyone has two friends who are secretly nutso for birds. Just tag them in the post, and we'll see what happens. Some of the crow sounds you heard on this show today came from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Many of the other sounds you heard on this episode came from the amazing collection over at freesound.org. In the last section of the show, you heard some really stunning recordings of death rituals from around the world, including Bali, Colombia, Laos, Ghana, and Hong Kong. Creative Commons attribution for some of those recordings include Freesound users Luke IRL, RTB45, Renato Ferrobouf, and Klankbild. Sorry for the pronunciations. You also heard an audiobook excerpt from a collection of children's stories recorded and released in the public domain by the amazing volunteers over at LibriVox.org. And last, but so far from least, this track that's acting as the bookends for this episode, it's a brand new release from Flower Petal Downpour. You also heard tracks from Cirocell and The Black Spot. You can find Here Be Monsters anywhere that fine podcasts are housed, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Podbay. And while I encourage you to subscribe at the place which is most convenient for you, what those sites can't do is show you the beautiful picture gallery that accompanies this episode. And believe me, you want to see these pictures. We have pictures of me wearing Michelle's mask, we have pictures of birds flying in over the wetlands, the taxidermied crow, the caveman, and Kaylee posing with the empty, lifeless mask on each hand. All that, and so much more, at our home on the internet. That's hbmpodcast.com. All right. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.